Beulah did not learn to sing and talked very little. Gibbons suspected that she was afraid to open her mouth in Buck's presence. She was willing to talk, or at least to answer, when Gibbons rode her alone. For it worked out, to Gibbons' surprise, that Beulah was his saddle mule. Dora rode the big male brute, even when the stirrups of the stock saddle had to be shortened ridiculously to fit her child's legs. But steadily the stirrups had to be lengthened as Dora grew toward young womanhood. Beulah dropped a foal. Gibbons kept her, and Dora named her Betty, and trained the baby mule as she grew, at first letting her amble along behind with an empty saddle, then teaching her to accept a rider in the paddock. There followed a time when their daily rides became sixums, and often picnics, with Mrs. Mayberry up on Buck, the steadiest, and with the lightest load, Dora, on Betty, and with Gibbons, as usual, riding Beulah. Gibbons remembered that summer as a most happy one. Helen and himself, knee to knee, on the older mounts, while Dora and the frisky youngster galloped ahead, then running back with Dora's long brown hair flying in the breeze. One such time he asked, "Helen, are the boys beginning to sniff around her?"
"You old stud, don't you think about anything else?"
"Come off it, dear. I asked for information." "Certainly the boys are noticing her, Ernest, and she is noticing them. But I will do all the worrying necessary. Not much. She's far too choosy to put up with second best." The happy family picnics did not resume the following summer. Mrs. Mayberry was feeling the gears in her bones. I could mount and dismount only with help. Gibbons had plenty of time to be ready before the murmurings about his monopoly of the banking business came to a head. The New Beginnings Bank of Commerce was a bank of issue. He, or Zacher, always set up such a bank in each colony they pioneered. Money was necessary to a growing colony. Barter was too clumsy. Some medium of exchange was needed even before government was needed. He was not surprised when he was invited to meet with the town selectmen to discuss the matter. It always happened. That evening, as he trimmed his Van Dyke and added a touch more gray to it, and to the hair on his head, in preparation for the confrontation, he reviewed in his mind proposals he had heard in the past for making water run uphill, the sun to stand still, and one egg to be counted as two. Would there be some novel numbskullery tonight? He hoped so, but did not expect it. He plucked hairs from his receding hairline. Damn it, it was getting harder and harder to age enough each year. Then put on his war-plaid kilt, not only more impressive, but with more ways to conceal weapons, and get at them quickly. He was fairly sure that no one was as yet annoyed enough at him to start violence, but once he had been too optimistic. Since that time, he had been a pessimist, as a fixed policy. Then he hit some items, locked up others, set some gadgets that Zacher had fetched last trip, but which were not offered for sale at the top dollar TP, unlocked his door, hand-locked it from outside, and left by the route through the bar, so that he could tell the barkeep that he would be away a few minutes. 3 hours later, Gibbons had settled one point. No one had been able to think of any new way to debase currency that he had not heard at least 500 years earlier, more likely 1,000, and each was certainly much, much older in history. Early in the meeting, he asked the moderator to have the town scribe write down each question so that he could answer them in a lump, and was allowed to have it his way by being balky. At last, the moderator selectman, Jim Duke Warwick, said, "That seems to be it. Ernie, we have a motion to nationalize, I guess that's the word, the New Beginnings Bank of Commerce. You're not a selectman, but we all agree that you are party with a special interest. We want to hear from you. Do you want to speak against the proposal?"
"Not at all, Jim. Go right ahead."
"No? I'm afraid I didn't understand you."
"I have no objection to the bank being nationalized, if that's all. Let's adjourn and go to bed."
Someone in the audience called out,
"Hey! I want my question about new Pittsburgh money answered."
"And mine about interest. Interest is wrong," It says so in the Bible.
Well, Ernie, you said earlier that you would answer questions.
So I did. But if you were nationalizing the bank, wouldn't it make more sense to put questions to your state treasurer, or whatever you decide to call him? The new head of the bank? By the way, who is he? Hadn't he better sit up here on the platform?
Warwick pounded his gavel and said, "We haven't got that far, Ernie. For the time being, the entire council of selectmen is the finance committee. If we go ahead with this..."
"Oh, by all means, go ahead. I'm shutting down."
What do you mean?
"Just what I said. A quit. A man doesn't like to have his neighbors dislike him. The people of Top Dollar don't like what I've been doing, or this meeting would never have been called. So I've quit. The bank is closed. It will not reopen tomorrow, nor ever, with me as president of it. That's why I asked who your state treasurer will be. I'm as interested as anyone to find out what we are going to use for money from here on, and what it will be worth."
There was dead silence. Then the moderator had to pound his gavel, and the sergeant-at-arms was very busy. All to shouts of, "What about my seed loan? You owe me money. I sold Hank Bofsky a mule on his personal note. What do I collect? You can't do this to us." Gibbons sat quietly, not letting his alertness show, until Warwick got them quieted down. Then Warwick said, wiping sweat from his brow, "Ernie, I think you've got some explaining to do."
"Certainly, Mr. Moderator. Liquidation will be as orderly as you will let it be. Those who have deposits will be paid, in banknotes, that being what was deposited. Those who owe money to the bank, well, I don't know. Depends on the policies the council sets up. I suppose I'm bankrupt. I can't know until you tell me what you mean when you say my bank is being nationalized. But I have had to take this step. Top Dollar Trading Post is no longer buying with banknotes. They may be worthless. Each deal will have to be barter, but we will continue to sell for banknotes. But I took down the posted prices just before I came here tonight, because the stock I have on hand may be all I ever have with which to redeem those banknotes, which could force me to raise prices. It all depends on whether nationalize is simply another word for confiscate." Gibbons spent several days explaining to Warwick the elementary principles of banking and currency, patiently and with good humor. To Warwick, by Hobson's choice, because the other selectmen found that they were too busy with their farms or businesses to take on the chore. There had been one candidate for the job of national banker, or state treasurer, no agreement as yet on title, from outside the selectmen, a farmer named Lemur. But his self-nomination got nowhere despite his claim of generations of experience in banking plus a graduate degree in such matters. Warwick got his first shock while he was taking inventory with Gibbons of the contents of the safe, almost the only safe on New Beginnings, and the only one of Earth manufacture. Ernie, where's the money?"
"What money, Duke?"
"What money? Why, these account books show that you've taken in thousands and thousands of dollars. Your own trading post shows a balance of nearly a million. And I know you've been collecting mortgage payments on 3 or 4 dozen farms and haven't loaned hardly anything for a year or more. That's been one of the major complaints. Ernie, why the selectmen just had to act? All that money going into the bank and none coming out. Money scarce everywhere. So where's the money, man?"
"I burned it," Gibbons answered cheerfully.
What?
"Certainly, it was piling up and getting too bulky. I didn't dare keep it outside the safe, even though we don't have much theft here. If somebody stole it, it could ruin me. So far the past 3 years, as money came into the bank, I've been burning it, to keep it safe."
"Good God.
What's the trouble, Duke? It's just waste paper."
Waste paper? It's money!"
"What is money, Duke? Got any on you? Say a $10 bill?"
Warwick, still looking shocked, dug out one.
"Read it, Duke," Gibbons urged. "Never mind the fancy engraving and the pretty paper that can't be made here as yet. Read what it says."
"It says $10.
So it does. But the important part is where it says that this bank will accept that note at face value in payment of debts to the bank. Gibbons took out of his sporran $1,000 banknote, set fire to it, while Warwick watched in horrified fascination. Gibbons rubbed the char off his fingers. Waste paper, Duke. As long as it's in my possession. But if I let it get into circulation, it becomes my IOU that I must honor. Half a moment while I record that serial number. I keep track of what I burn so that I know how much is still in circulation. Quite a lot, but I can tell you to the dollar. Are you going to honor my IOUs? And what about debts owed to the bank? Who gets paid, you or me? Warwick looked baffled. Ernie, I just don't know. Hell, man, I'm a mechanic by trade. But you heard what they said at the meeting. Yeah, I heard. People always expect a government to work miracles, even people who are fairly bright other ways. Let's lock up this junk and go over to the Waldorf and have a beer and discuss it. Oh, it should be, Duke, simply a public bookkeeping service and credit system in which the medium of exchange is stable. Anything more, and you are jiggering with other people's wealth, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Duke, I did my best to keep the dollar stable by keeping key prices stable. Seed wheat in particular. For over 20 years, the top dollar trading post has paid the same price for prime seed wheat, then resold it at the same markup, even if I took a loss, and sometimes I did. Seed wheat isn't too good a money standard. It's perishable. But we don't have gold or uranium as yet, and it has to be something. Now look, Duke, when you reopen a treasury or a government central bank or whatever you call it, you're certain to have pressures on you to do all sorts of things. Lower the interest rates, expand the money supply, guarantee high prices to the farmer for what he sells, guarantee low prices for what he buys. Brother, you're going to be called worse names than they call me no matter what you do. Ernie, there's only one thing for it. You know how, so you've got to take the job of community treasurer. Gibbons laughed heartily. Oh, no sorry, bub. I've had that headache for more than 20 years now. Now it's your turn. You grab the sack. Now you hold it. If I let you put me back in as banker, all that will happen is that they will lynch both of us. Changes. Helen Mayberry married the widower Parkinson, went to live with him in a small new house on the farm, now worked by two of his sons. Dora Brandon became schoolmistress of what was still called Mrs. Mayberry's primary school. Ernest Gibbons, no longer banker, was now silent partner in Rick's general store, while his own warehouses bulged with cargo for the Andy J., if and when. Soon, he hoped, as the new inventory tax was eating into cash he had held out for trading, and inflation was eating into the buying power of that cash. Better hurry, Zach, before we are nibbled to death by ducks. At last the ship appeared in New Beginning Sky, and Captain Zachar Briggs came down with the first load of the fourth wave, almost all of them quite old. Gibbons refrained from comment until the partners were alone. Zach, where did you find those walking corpses? Call it charity, Ernest. That sounds better than what did happen. Such as? Captain Sheffield, if you want our ship to go back to Earth again, you are welcome to take her there yourself. Not me. Not there. If a man is 75 years old there now, he becomes officially dead. His heirs inherit. He can't own property. His ration books are canceled. Anybody can kill him just for the hell of it. I didn't get these passengers on Earth. They were refugees at Luna City, and I took as many as I could. No messroom passengers. Cold sleep or nothing. I insisted on payment in hardware and pharmaceuticals, but cold sleep let me hold down the price per head. I think we'll break even. If not, we've got investments on Secundus. I haven't lost money for us, I think. Zach, you worry too much. Make money, lose money, who cares? The idea is to enjoy it. Tell me where we are going next, and I can begin picking cargo. I got twice the metric tonnage we can stow. While you get her loaded, I'll liquidate what we aren't lifting and invest the proceeds. Leave it with a Howard, that is. Gibbons looked thoughtfully. This new situation probably means no clinic here anytime soon. I think that is certain, Ernest. Any Howard who needs rejuvenation soon had better take passage with us. We are bound to hit Secundus in a leg or six, no matter where we go. Then you are definitely coming along? All over your, problem? What became of that baby girl, the short-lifer? Gibbons grinned. I don't think I'll let you lay eyes on her, son. I know you. Captain Briggs' arrival caused Gibbons to miss 3 days running his usual daily ride with Dora Brandon. On the fourth day, he showed up at the schoolhouse as school let out, Briggs having gone back for a couple of days. Got time for a ride today? She flashed him a smile. You know I have. Half a minute while I change. They rode out of town, Gibbons as usual riding Beulah, but with Dora on Betty. Buck was saddled, for his pride, but the saddle was empty. He was now ridden only ceremonially. By mule years, he was quite old. They paused on a sunny hilltop well out of town. Gibbons said, Why so silent, little Dora? Buck has had more to say than you have. She turned in the saddle and faced him. How many more rides will we have together? Is this the last?
Why, Dora, of course we'll have more rides together.
I wonder. Lazarus,
What did you call me?
I called you by your name. Lazarus. He stared at her thoughtfully.
Dora, you're not supposed to know that name. I'm your Uncle Gibby.
Uncle Gibby is gone, and so is little Dora. I'm almost as tall as you are now, and I've known for 2 years who you are, and I had guessed it before that. Guessed that you were one of the Methuselahs, I mean. But I said nothing to anyone, and never will.
Don't make a promise, Dora. It isn't necessary. It's just that I never meant to burden you with it. How did I give myself away? I thought I'd been most careful.
You have been. But I have seen you nearly every day, almost as far back as I can remember. Little things. Things no one would notice who didn't see you. Really look at you every day.
Well, yes. But I didn't expect to have to keep it up so long. Helen knew?
I think she did. We never spoke of it. But I think she guessed the same way I did. And she may have figured out which Methuselah you are.
Don't call me that, dear. It's like calling a Jew a kike. I'm a member of the Howard families. A Howard.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that the name mattered.
Well, it doesn't really. It's just a word that reminds me of a time long ago. A time of persecution. Sorry, Dora. You were telling me how you learned that my name is Lazarus? One of my names, that is, for I am Ernest Gibbons, just as truly.
Yes. Uncle Gibby. It was in a book, a picture. A microbook one has to read with the viewer at the town library. I saw this picture and winked on past it, then clicked back and looked again. You weren't wearing whiskers in the picture and your hair was longer. But the longer I stared at it, the more it looked like my foster uncle. But I couldn't be sure, and I couldn't ask.
Why not, Dora? I would have told you the truth.
If you had wanted me to know, you would have told me. You always have reasons for everything you do, everything you say. I learned that when I was so little we used to ride the same saddle. So, I didn't say anything. Until today. Knowing that you are leaving.
Have I said that I was leaving?
Please. Once, when I was very little, you told me a story about when you were a little boy hearing wild geese honking in the sky. How, when you grew up, you wanted to find out where they went. I didn't know what a wild goose was. You had to explain it to me. I know you follow the wild goose. When you hear them honking, you have to go. You've been hearing them in your head for 3 or 4 years. I know, because when you hear them, I hear them too. And now the ship is here, and it's very loud in your head, so I knew.
Dora, I...
Don't, please. I'm not trying to hold you back. Truly, I'm not. But before you go, I want something very much.
What, Dora?
Didn't mean to tell you this yet, but I'm leaving some property for you with John McGee. Should be enough for...
No, no, please. I'm a grown woman now and self-supporting. What I want doesn't cost anything.
She looked at him steadily in the eye.
I want your child, Lazarus.
Lazarus Long took a deep breath, tried to steady his heartbeat.
Dora. Dora, my dear, you are hardly more than a child yourself. It is too soon for you to be talking about having one. You don't want to marry me.
I did not ask you to marry me.
I was trying to say that. In a year or two, or three, or four, you will want to marry. Then you will be glad that you did not have my child.
You refuse me this?
I'm saying that you must not let an emotional upset over parting cause you to make any such hasty decision.
She sat very straight in the saddle, squared her shoulders. It is not a hasty decision, sir. I made up my mind long ago, even before I guessed that you were a Howard. Long before. I told Aunt Helen, and she said that I was a silly girl and that I must forget it. But I have never forgotten it. And if I was a silly girl then, I am much older now and know what I am doing. Lazarus, I am not asking for anything else. It could be syringes and such with Doc Krausmeier's help, or... Again, she looked him squarely in the eyes. It could be the usual way.
She dropped her eyes, then looked up again, smiled briefly, and added,
But either way, it had best be quickly. I don't know the ship's schedule. I do know mine.
Gibbons spent all of a half second reviewing certain factors in his mind.
Dora.
Yes?
Ernest.
My name is not Ernest. Nor is it Lazarus. My right name is Woodrow Wilson Smith. So since I am no longer Uncle Gibby, and you are right on that point, Uncle Gibby is gone and will never be back. You might as well call me Woodrow.
Yes, Woodrow.
Do you want to know why I had to change my name?
No, Woodrow.
So, do you want to know how old I am?
No, Woodrow.
But you want to have a child by me?
Yes, Woodrow.
Will you marry me?
Her eyes widened slightly. But she answered at once, No, Woodrow.
Minerva, at that point, Dora and I almost had our first and last and only quarrel. She had been a sweet and lovable baby who had grown into a sweet-tempered and utterly lovable young woman. But she was as stubborn as I am, with a sort of firmness that can't be argued with, because she would not argue. I pay her the respect of believing that she had thought this through, all aspects, and had long since made up her mind to bear my child if I would let her, but not to marry me. As for me, I did not ask her to marry me on impulse. It just sounds like it. A supersaturated solution will crystallize almost instantly. That's the shape I was in. I had lost interest in that colony years earlier, as soon as it stopped presenting real challenges. I was itching to do something else. At the top of my mind, I thought I was waiting for Zack to return, but when the Andy J finally did orbit in that sky, 2 years overdue, well, I learned that it was not what I had been waiting for. When Dora made that amazing request, I knew what I had been waiting for. Surely I tried to argue her out of it, but I was playing devil's advocate. In fact, my mind was busy with what and how. All the objections to marrying a short lifer still remained. My even stronger objections to leaving a pregnant woman behind me. Shucks, dear. I didn't spend a nanosecond on that.
Why not, Dora?
I told you. You were leaving. I will not hold you back.
You won't hold me back. No one ever has yet, Dora. But, no marriage, no child.
She looked thoughtful. What is your purpose in insisting on a marriage ceremony, Woodrow? So that our child will bear your name? I don't want to be a sky widow, but if that is what it takes, let's ride back to town and find the moderator.
because it really should be today, if the books are right about how to figure it.
Woman, you talk too much.
She did not answer this. He went on.
I don't give a hoot about a wedding ceremony. Certainly not one in top dollar.
She hesitated, then said, May I say that I do not understand?
Huh? Yes, surely. Dora, I won't settle for one child. You're going to have half a dozen children by me, or more. Probably more. Maybe a dozen. Any objection?
Yes, Woodrow. I mean, no. I do not object. Yes, I will have a dozen children by you, or more.
Having a dozen kids takes time, Dora. How often should I show up? Every 2 years? Maybe?
Whatever you say, Woodrow. Whenever you come back, each time you come back, I'll have a child by you. But I do ask that we start the first one at once.
You crazy little idiot. I believe you would do it that way.
Not would, shall, if you will.
Well, we're not going to do it that way.
He reached out and took her hand.
Dora, will you go where I go? Do what I do? Live where I live?
She looked startled, but answered steadily. Yes, Woodrow, if this is truly what you want.
Don't put any conditions on it. Will you, or won't you?
I will.
If it comes to a showdown, will you do what I tell you to? Not give me any more stubborn arguments?
Yes, Woodrow.
Will you bear my children and be my wife till death do us part?
I will.
I take thee, Dora, to be my wife, to love and protect and cherish, and never to leave you, so long as we both shall live. Don't sniffle. Lean over here and kiss me instead. We're married.
I was not either sniffling. Are we really married?
We are. Oh, you can have any wedding ceremony you want later. Now shut up and kiss me.
She obeyed. Some long moments later, he said,
Hey, don't fall out of your saddle. Steady, Betty. Steady, Beulah. Adorable Dora, who taught you to kiss that way?
You haven't called me that since I started to grow up. Years.
Haven't kissed you since you started to grow up either. For good reason. You didn't answer my question.
Is that one of the things I just promised? Whoever taught me to kiss? It was before I was a married woman.
You may have a point there. I'll take it up with my legal staff and have them write you a letter. Besides, it might be native talent rather than instruction. Tell you what, Dora, I'll refrain from quizzing you about your sinful past, and you leave mine alone. A deal?
Yes, indeed, for I have a very sinful past.
Piffle, darling. You haven't had time to be sinful. Swipe some sweets I had fetched for Buck, maybe. Very sinful.
I never did any such thing, but lots worse.
Ah, sure. Give me another of those native talent kisses.
Presently, he said,
Whew! No, the first one wasn't a fluke. Dora, I think I married you just barely in time.
You insisted on marrying me, my husband. I didn't make an issue of it.
Conceded. Sweetheart, are you still anxious to get started on that baby, now that you know that I am not going away without you?
No longer anxious. Eager, perhaps. Yes, eager is the right word, but not demanding.
Eager is a fine word. Me too. I could also add demanding. Who knows? You may have other native talents.
She barely smiled. If not, Woodrow, I'm sure you can teach me. I'm willing to learn. Eager.
Let's head back to town. My apartment or the schoolhouse?
Either one, Woodrow. But see that little stand of trees? It's much closer. It was almost dark as they neared town. They rode back at a gentle walk. As they passed the Markham's house, on the old Harper place, Woodrow Wilson Smith said,
Adorable Dora.
Yes, my husband?
Do you want a public wedding?
Only if you want one, Woodrow. I feel very much married. I am married.
You certainly are.
Not going to run away with a younger man.
Is that a rhetorical question?
Not now or ever.
This young man is an immigrant who may not be down, and this young man is an immigrant who may not be down until the last or nearly the last trip. He's about my height, but he has black hair and a darker skin than I have. Can't say just how old he is, but he looks about half the age I look. Smooth-shaven. His friends call him Bill, or Woody. Captain Briggs says Bill is very fond of young schoolmarms and is anxious to meet you.
She appeared to consider it. If I kissed him with my eyes closed, do you think I would recognize him?
It's possible, adorable, almost certain, but I don't think anyone else will. I hope they don't.
Woodrow, I don't know your plans, but if I do recognize this Bill, should I attempt to convince him that I am that other schoolmarm, the one you were singing about, Rangy Lil?
I think you could convince him, dearest one. All right. Uncle Gibby is back, temporarily. It will take Ernest Gibbons 3 or 4 days to wind up what he must do here. Then he'll say goodbye to people, including his foster niece, that old maid schoolmarm Dora Brandon. 2 days later, this Bill Smith comes down with the last, or nearly the last, load of cargo from the ship. You had better be packed and ready to leave by then, because Bill is going to drive past your schoolhouse the following day, or the day after that, just before dawn, headed for New Pittsburgh.
New Pittsburgh. I'll be ready.
I won't stay there more than a day or two. Only go, past separation, then right over the horizon. We're going to tackle Hopeless Pass, dear. Does that appeal to you?
I go where you go.
Does it appeal to you? You won't have anyone to talk to but me, until you bake one and teach him or her to talk. No neighbors. Lopers and dragons and God knows what else, but no neighbors.
So I'll cook, and help you farm, and bake babies. When I have three, I'll open Mrs. Smith's primary school. Or should we call it Rangy Lil's primary school?
The latter, I think. For young hellions. My kids are always hellraisers, Dora. You'll teach school with a club in your hand.
If necessary, Woodrow. I've got some like that now, and two of them outweigh me. I clobber them as necessary.
Dora, we don't have to tackle Hopeless Pass. We could leave in the Andy J and go to Secundus. Briggs tells me that there are over 20 million people there now. You could have a nice house, inside plumbing, a flower garden instead of breaking your back helping me to make a farm, a good hospital with real doctors when you have babies, safety and comfort.
Secundus, that's where all the Howards moved, isn't it?
About 2/3 of them. A few are right here, as I told you, but we don't admit it because when you are outnumbered, it is neither safe nor comfortable to be a Howard. Dora, you don't have to make up your mind in only 3 or 4 days. That ship will stay in orbit here as long as I want it to. Weeks, months, as long as I order it to stay.
Goodness! You can afford to have Captain Briggs hold a starship in orbit? Just to let me make up my mind?
I shouldn't have rushed you. But it's not exactly a case of affording it, Dora. Although it doesn't cost much to stay in orbit. I've kept my own counsel so long that I'm out of the habit of being a married man, with a wife I can trust with secrets. I must stop it. I own 60% of the Andy J, Dora. Zach Briggs is my junior partner and my son. Your stepson, you could say.
She did not answer at once. Presently he said,
"What's the trouble, Dora? Did I shock you?"
No, Woodrow. I'm just having to get used to new ideas. Of course you've been married before. You're a Howard. I'd never thought about it, that's all. Sons, and daughters, too, no doubt.
Yes, surely. But what I was getting at is that I've done some bad planning, through my own selfishness. I was rushing you when there is no need for it. If we stay on New Beginnings, I want Ernest Gibbons to disappear. Leave in the Andy J, that is, as he is getting too old. I can't keep it up much longer. So young Bill Smith, who is much nearer your age, takes his place.
which looks better, and no one will ever suspect that I'm a Howard. I've worked this shenanigan many times. I know how to make it stand up. But I was trying to get rid of Ernest Gibbons as fast as possible because he's your old foster uncle who was about 3 times your age and wouldn't dream of patting your pretty bottom, nor would you encourage him to, as everybody knows. But I want to pat your pretty bottom, Dorable. And I want you to pat it. She reined up. They were getting close to where houses were near together. And more. Woodrow, you're saying that we can't live together right away because of what the neighbors might think. But who taught me never to care what the neighbors think? You did. True. Although sometimes it's expedient to make the neighbors think what you want them to think in order to influence what they do and say. And this might be such a time. But I also tried to teach you to be patient, dear one. Woodrow, I will do exactly what you tell me to. But I'm not really patient about this. I want my husband in my bed. And I want to be there. And what does it matter if people assume that I choose to tell my Uncle Gibby goodbye in bed? Or that I then go away with a new settler almost at once? Woodrow, you didn't say a word about it at the time, but you knew that I was not virgin. I'm certain. Don't you think there must be others who know it too? Probably the whole town. I've never worried about it. Why should I worry what they think now? Dora. Yes, Woodrow? I'll be in your bed every night. That's settled. Thank you, Woodrow. The pleasure is mine, madam. Or half of it, at least. You seem to enjoy it, too. Oh, I do. And you know it, or should. So stipulated. Let's pass to other matters, except to say that had I found you virgin, big as you are, old as you are, it would have worried me a little. And I might have felt that Helen had not been quite the wholesome influence that I thought she was. That she was indeed, bless her heart. The matter of pretending to be dear old Uncle Gibby who would never touch little Dora was purely for your face. Since it does not worry you, let's drop it. What I started to say is that you can take as long as you like in deciding whether to pioneer here or go to Secundus. Dora, Secundus has more than inside plumbing. It has a rejuvenation clinic. Oh, you need to be near one, Woodrow? No, for you, dear. She was very slow in answering. That would not make me a Howard. Well, no, but it helps. Rejuvenation therapies don't make Howards last forever, either. Some people are helped quite a lot by them. Some are not. Maybe someday we'll know more. But now, on the average, rejuvenation techniques seem to about double whatever a person could expect normally, whether he's a Howard or not a Howard. Do you know anything about how long your grandparents lived? How could I, Woodrow? I just barely remember that I once had parents. I don't even know the names of my grandparents. We can find out. The ship carries records of every migrant who takes passage in her. I'll tell Zach, Captain Briggs, to look up your parents' records. Then, in time, for it will take time, I can have your family traced on Earth. Then, no, Woodrow. Why not, dear? I don't need to know. I don't want to know. Long ago, 3 or 4 years at least, shortly after I figured out that you were a Howard, I also figured out that Howards don't really live any longer than we ordinaries do. So? Yes. We all have the past and the present and the future. The past is just memory, and I can't remember when I began. I can't remember when I wasn't. Can you? No. So, we're even on that. I suppose your memories are richer. You are older than I am, but it's past. The future? It hasn't happened yet, and nobody knows. You may outlive me, or I may outlive you. Or we might happen to be killed at the same time. We can't know, and I don't want to know. What we both have is now, and we have that together, and it makes me utterly happy. Let's get these mules put away for the night and enjoy some now. Suits. He grinned at her. EF or, FF? Both. That's my Dora. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing.
and doing again. But just a moment, dear. You told me that Captain Briggs is your son, and consequently my stepson. I suppose he is, but I really can't think of him as such. But you needn't answer this. We agreed not to quiz each other about our pasts. Go ahead and ask if it suits me. I'll answer it. Well, I can't help being curious about Captain Briggs's mother, your former wife.
Phyllis? Phyllis Briggs Sperling is her full name. What do you want to know about her, dear? Very nice girl. Further deponent saith not. No invidious comparisons.
I guess I'm being snoopy.
Perhaps you are. Not that I mind. And it can't hurt Phyllis. Dear, that was a couple of centuries ago. Forget it.
Oh, she's dead?
Not that I know of. Zack would know. He's been to Secundus recently. I think he would have told me. But I haven't stayed in touch with her since she divorced me.
Divorced you? A woman of poor taste.
Dora, Dora! Phyllis is not a woman of poor taste. She's a very nice girl. I had dinner with her and her husband the last time I was on Secundus. Zack and I did, I mean. She and her husband had gone to the trouble of rounding up my other children by her, those who were on planet, and some of my other relatives, and made it a family party for me. Thoughtful of her. By the way, she's a schoolmarm, too.
She is?
Yep. Lady Professor of Mathematics, Howard University, New Rome, Secundus. If we go there, we can look her up, and you can decide for yourself what sort of person she is.
Dora did not answer. She kneed Betty and started on down the street.
Beulah pulled a breath without being told. Buck said, "Shopper, dime," quite emphatically, and trotted on ahead.
Lazarus?
Careful with that name, dear.
No one can hear me. Lazarus, unless you insist, I don't want to live on Secundus.
Variations on a Theme, 12. The Tale of the Adopted Daughter continued. Separation lay far behind. For 3 weeks, the little train, 2 wagons in tandem, 12 mules hauling, 4 running free, had crawled toward Rampart Range. It had been more than 2 weeks since they had last seen a house. They were on the high prairies now, and for several days the gap of Hopeless Pass had been in sight. Besides 16 mules, the little party included a German shepherd bitch and a younger dog, 2 female cats and a tom, a fresh milch goat with 2 kids and a young buck, 2 cocks and 6 hens of the hardy Mrs. Hawkins variety, a freshly bred sow, and Dora and Woodrow Smith. The sow had tested pregnant at New Pittsburgh before Smith paid for her, tests conducted by Smith himself, and Mrs. Smith had tested pregnant, too, while still at top dollar and before Smith cleared Starship Andy J to leave orbit. For Smith had not found it necessary to tell his wife this. If Dora had not tested pregnant, the ship would have waited while they tried again. Then if she had still tested negative, he would have changed plans and taken her to Secundus, there to find out why and, if possible, to correct it. In Smith's opinion, as a professional pioneer, it was not only pointless but disastrously foolhardy to attempt single-couple pioneering out of reach of other people with an infertile woman. Or a couple infertile with each other, he corrected in his mind, as his own fertility had not been put to the ultimate test for 50-odd years. While he was about it, he had looked up physical records of Dora's parents in Krausmeier's ill-kept files. Found nothing to worry him. And it had indeed worried him, as he would not have been able to cope even with anything as simple as an Rh factor incompatibility a long way from nowhere. But within the limited medical resources of colony and ship, the board showed all green, and it seemed likely to him that Dora had become pregnant about 20 minutes after their informal muleback wedding. And though it passed through his mind that Dora might have been pregnant even sooner, but the thought was merely an amusing whimsy that bothered him not at all. Smith felt certain that he had had the cuckoo in his nest more than once over the centuries. He had been especially careful to be a loving father to such children, and had kept his mouth shut. He believed in letting women lie all they needed to, and never taxing them with it. But he believed also that Dora was incapable of this sort of lie. If Dora had been pregnant and aware of it, she might have asked to be allowed to say goodbye to him on her back. But she would have asked for exactly that, not for a child, allowed to say goodbye to him on her back. But she would have asked for exactly that, not for a child. No matter. If the darling had made a mistake earlier and did not know it, he felt sure that she would nevertheless have a superior baby. She was clearly superior stock herself. He wished he had known the Brandons. They must have been Ichiban, and their daughter was, as Helen had once said, choosy. Dora would not bed with an oaf, even for fun, because, being what she was, she would not find it fun. Smith was sure that it would take rape to put an inferior child into Dora, and the rapist might sing soprano the rest of his days. Her Uncle Gibby had taught her some dirty tricks. The pregnant sow was Smith's calendar. If they failed to reach a spot suitable for homesteading by the time that sow littered, then they turned back that very day. No hesitation, no regrets, as that would leave them just half of Dora's pregnancy to get them back to separation and other people. The sow rode in the back end of the second wagon, with a sling to keep her from falling down. The dogs trotted under the wagons, or ranged aside, warning of lopers or other hazards. The cats did as they pleased, as cats do, walking or riding as suited them. The nanny and billy goats stayed close to the wheel pair. The two kids were large enough to skitter along most of the time, but were privileged to ride when they tired. A loud meh from the mother goat would cause Smith to swing down and hand the tired baby up to Dora. The chickens complained in a double cage over the sow's pen. The mules, running free, had no duties other than to keep eyes out for lopers, save that Buck was at all times grand marshal of the parade, picking the footing, bossing the other mules, carrying out Smith's orders. Mules at liberty rotated as draft animals. Only Buck was never in harness. Betty and Beulah had had their feelings hurt at being required to accept harness. They were gentry of the saddle, and they knew it. But Buck had had harsh words with them, and harsher nips and kicks. They had shut up and hauled. No real driving was required. Only two reins were used, one to each of the lead pair, and running from them back through rings on the collars of the following mules to the seat of the leading wagon, there, usually, loosely secured rather than held. Although the males were all stallions, these mules did what Buck ordered. Smith had stopped at separation and lost most of a day to trade a strong brute with good shoulders for a younger, lighter stud because the bigger mule had not been willing to accept Buck's dominance. Buck was ready to fight it out, but Smith did not let the old mule risk it. He needed Buck's brain and judgment, and would not risk Buck's spirit being broken by losing to a younger stallion, or take a chance that Buck might be injured. In real trouble, more reins would not help. If the mules panicked and ran, unlikely but possible, two humans could not hold them, even with a double handful of reins. Smith was ready at any instant to pick off his lead pair, then hope that not too many mules would break legs stumbling over the corpses, and pray that the wagons would not overturn. Smith wanted to reach their destination with all his livestock. He hoped to get there with about 80%, including a breeding pair of each sort. But if they arrived with enough draft animals to pull the wagon, including at least one breeding pair, plus a pair of goats, he could consider it a conditional victory, and they would make their stand, to live or to die. How many mules were enough was a variable. Near the end of the trip, it could be as low as 4, then go back and get the second wagon. But if the number of mules dropped below 12 before they conquered Hopeless Pass, turn back. Turn back at once. Abandon one or both wagons. Jettison what they could not salvage. Slaughter any animals that could not make it without help. Travel light with any extra mules trailing along. Unwitting walking larders. If Woodrow Wilson Smith limped back into separation on foot, his wife riding, miscarried but still alive, it still would not be defeat. He had his hands. He had his brain. He had the strongest of human incentives, a wife to care for and cherish. In a few years, they might try Hopeless Pass again, and not make the mistakes he had made the first time. In the meantime, he was happy, with all the wealth any man could hope for. Smith leaned out of the wagon seat. "Hey, Buck. Supper time."
"Supper time,"
Buck repeated, then called out, "Supper time. Shukonai, shukonai." The lead pair turned left, started bringing the train around in a circle. Dora said, "The sun is still high."
"Yes," her husband agreed, "and that's why. The sun is high. It's very hot. The mules are tired and sweaty and hungry and thirsty. I want them to graze. Tomorrow we'll be up before dawn and rolling at first light. Make as many kilometers as possible before it gets too bloody hot. Then another early stop."
"I wasn't questioning it, dear. I simply wanted to know why. I'm finding that being a schoolmarm hasn't taught me all I need to know to be a pioneer wife."
"I understand. That's why I explained."
"Dora, always ask me if I do anything you don't understand. You do have to know. Because if something happens to me, then it'll be up to you. Just hold your questions until later if I seem to be in a hurry." "I'll try, Woodrow. I am trying. I'm hot and thirsty myself. These poor dears must be feeling it dreadfully. If you can spare me, I'll water them while you unharness."
"No, Dora."
"But, sorry.
Damn it, I said always ask why. But I was about to explain. First, we let them graze an hour. That will cool them down some in spite of the sun. And being thirsty, they'll look for short green stuff under the tall dry stuff. They will get a little moisture out of that. Meantime, I'm going to measure the water barrels. But I know that we're going on short water rations. Should have yesterday. Durable, you see that patch of dark green way up there below the pass? I think there is water there, dry as it's been. And pray hard that there is, because I don't expect to find water between here and there. We may have no water at all the last day or so. It doesn't take a mule long to die without water, and not much longer for a man."
"Woodrow, is it as bad as that?"
"It is, dear. That's why I've been studying the photo maps. The clearest ones Andy and I made a long time ago when we surveyed this planet, but in early spring for this hemisphere. The shots Zack took from me aren't much. The Andy J isn't equipped as a survey ship. As may be, I took this route because it looked faster, but every wash we've crossed the past 10 days has been bone dry. My mistake, and it may be my last one."
"Woodrow, don't talk that way."
"Sorry, dear. But there is always a last mistake. I'll do my damnedest to see that this is not my last mistake, because it must not happen to you. I'm simply trying to impress you with how carefully we must conserve water."
"You've impressed me. I'll be most careful with cleaning up and so forth."
"I still haven't made it clear. There will be no washing at all. Not a face wash, not even a hand wash. Pant and such you'll scour with dirt and grass and put them in sunshine and hope they sterilize. Water is only for drinking. The mules go on half water rations at once, and you and I, instead of the liter and a half of liquid each day a human is supposed to need, will each try to get by on a half liter. Mrs. Whiskers will get a full ration of water. She has to make milk for her kids. If it gets too tough, we slaughter the kids and let her dry up."
"Oh, dear."
"We may not have to, but Dora, we aren't even close to last extremities. If the going gets really tough, we kill a mule and drink its blood."
"What? Why, they're our friends."
"Dora, listen to your old man. I promise you that we will never kill Buck or Beulah or Betty. If I must, it will be a mule we bought in New Pittsburgh. But if one of our three old friends die, we eat him, or her."
"I don't think I could."
"You will when you're hungry enough. If you think about the baby inside you, you'll eat without hesitation and bless your dead friend for helping to keep your baby alive. Don't talk about what you can't do when the chips are down, dear, because you can. Did Helen ever tell you stories about the first winter here?
No. She said I didn't need to know.
Could be she was mistaken. I'll tell you one of the less grisly ones. We placed, I placed, a heel-to-toe watch over the seed grain, with orders to shoot to kill. And one guard did. A drumhead court-martial exonerated the guard. The man he killed was clearly stealing seed grain. His corpse had half-chewed grain in its mouth. Not Helen's husband, by the way. He died like a gentleman. Malnutrition and some fever I never identified. Smith added, Bucks got us hauled around. Let's get busy. He jumped down, reached up to help her. And smile, baby, smile. The show is being transmitted back to Earth to show those poor, crowded people how easy it is to take a new planet. Courtesy of Dewberry's delicious deodorants, of which I need a bucketful. She smiled. I stink worse than you do, my love. That's better, darling. We'll make it. It's just the first step that's a dilly. Oh, yes, no cooking fire. Yes, sir. Nor any until we get out of this dry stuff. Don't strike a light for any reason, even if you drop your rubies and can't find them. Rubies? Woodrow, it was wonderful of you to give me rubies. But right now, I'd swap them for another barrel of water. No, you wouldn't, dearest, because rubies don't weigh anything, and I took every barrel the mules could haul. I was delighted that Zack had those rubies along, and I could give them to you. A bride should be cherished. Let's take care of these tired mules. After they turned the mules loose, Dora tried to figure out what she would feed her husband without the use of fire while Smith got busy on the fence. The fence was not much, but having only two wagons, they could not form a proper defensive circle. The best that could be done was to angle the wagons as far as the front axle of the second wagon permitted, then surround the bivouac with a fence of sorts, sharpened stakes of brasswood, each 2 meters long, and held together and spaced by what passed for rope in New Pittsburgh. The result, when held up on two sides by wagons and braced to the ground along the hypotenuse, constituted a high and fairly nasty picket fence. It would not slow up a dragon, but this was not dragon country. Lopers did not like it. Smith did not like it much either. But it was made on new beginnings of all native materials. Could be repaired by a man who was handy, did not weigh much, could be abandoned with no great loss, and contained no metal. Smith had been able to buy two sturdy, boat-bodied, Conestoga-type wagons in New Pittsburgh only by offering in part payment complete hardware for two other wagons, hardware imported across the light years in the Andy J. New Pittsburgh was far more new than Pittsburgh. There was iron ore there and coal, but its metals industry was still primitive. The chickens, the sow, the goats, and even the humans were tasty temptations to wild lopers, but with the goats and kids shooed inside the kraal, two alert watchdogs, and 16 mules grazing on all sides, Smith felt reasonably secure at night. True, a loper might get a mule, but it was much more likely that the mule would get the loper, especially as other mules would close in and help stomp the carnivore. These mules did not run from a loper. They struck out at him. Smith thought that in time, mules might clean out the varmints even more than man did, make them as scarce as mountain lions had been in his youth. A mule-stomped loper was readily converted into loper steak, loper stew, loper jerky, and dog and cat food, and Mrs. Porky, the sow, enjoyed the offal. All at no loss to the mules. Smith did not care much for loper in any form. The meat was too strongly flavored for his taste, but it was better than nothing, and kept them from digging too deeply into food they had hauled along. Dora did not share her husband's distaste for loper meat. Born there, and having eaten it now and then since earliest childhood, it seemed to her a normal food. But Smith wished he had time to hunt one of the herbivores that were the loper's natural prey.
six-legged, like the loper, but otherwise resembling a misshapen okapi. Their meat was much milder. They were called prairie goats, which they were not, but systematic taxonomy of fauna and flora in New Beginnings had not gone far. There had been as yet no time for such intellectual luxuries. Smith had shot a prairie goat from the seat of the wagon a week earlier, now only a memory, bittersweet, of tasty, tender meat. Smith did not feel justified in taking a day off to hunt.